So with the permission of the Maha Sangha, for my best wishes and appreciation for the attendance of everyone here at the meeting today. This is a historic occasion for me. This is the first time I've given a Dhamma talk with a warm-up act before. And often as a young monk, I would be invited to give talks at all-night Dhamma talk sessions, which go on in Thailand from about 8 in the evening till 5 in the morning. And I'd usually be invited about 1 o'clock in the morning when everyone's starting to get really sleepy. And then, oh, look, it's a Western monk. And he can speak Thai also. And everybody would wake up. So when I saw the schedule and I saw I'm on directly after lunch, I thought, oh, this is the same kind of idea. But then we had this wonderful group singing, and I see everyone laughing and clapping, so I don't have to do that. Yes, yeah, starting off with values, and of course must begin with sila. And I was speaking with the Venerable earlier this morning that one of the reasons why I chose to become a Theravadan Buddhist was because of the teaching of sila and the idea of a holistic threefold training of sila, samadhi, and panya. And sila as something which must arise from wisdom and must come from a wish to, a desire to limit one's actions and speech within voluntarily accepted boundaries. And the relationship between that kind of effort and the purification of the mind, I found to be extremely clearly presented in Theravada tradition. And what I was very wary of, after having had some experience of this, was of sects and movements in which the idea is that the spiritual teacher reaches ultimately a level in which he is beyond morality, in which he cannot be held to the same standards as an ordinary person. He's transcended them. And so it would be illegitimate, it would be incorrect to criticize someone of that stature for acting in ways which an ordinary person would be roundly condemned for. And so I found that that's a very dangerous attitude to take, dangerous for communities and dangerous for spiritual teachers themselves, because even in the Buddhist time, there were monks who overestimated their attainment, even with the Buddha and the great arahants around as Kalyanamitas. So how much more is the possibility and the likelihood of spiritual overestimation in the present day and age? It seemed to me that our Theravada tradition is a safe and trustworthy tradition because make very clear, particularly in the monastic order, that even a monk who has been in the robes for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, is expected to keep every single rule that one who has been a monk for only a day has to keep, even if he's an arahant, even more so if he's an arahant, because we have this idea of practicing for the sake of future generations. So even if you don't have to keep a particular moral code for one's own purification, that the mind is completely free of all tainted or defiled impulses, still one behaves within those boundaries as an example to others. And so when a young monk or nun or a young practitioner starts to develop in Dhamma and gets a little bit overconfident, and then the Mara and the defilement arise. I don't really need to do this anymore. I can do this, and I don't see any defilement arising. My mind is just completely unfazed by this. It's stable, it's clear. So why not? And this is the kind of dangerous thought that arises in people on the spiritual path, particularly as you have some experience in meditation. I don't really need to do this. And this is why we have this value that no matter how attained you are, you do it anyway. You do it anyway, even if you don't need to, out of compassion for your students and for late, and for future generations. And so this is the key values. Now, the being a spiritual teacher means that you're in everyone's eyes. Everyone's looking at you. Every good point, every bad point is not only magnified, but it's also distorted. And that's part of the karma of being a spiritual teacher. And there's no use complaining about that. That's just the way things are. And there is a lot of projection onto leaders. People will project onto you ideas of their father. So I can remember as having newly taken on the role as an abbot in a monastery, quite exasperated with one young American monk. I said, look, I'm not your father, all right? You know, don't treat me like your father, because I'm not. And so although the upacara or the ajahn fulfills the role of a parent or a father, the flip side of that is that dysfunctional relationships between the students and key figures in their life are often projected onto you as the new authority figure. And this is something else that you have to be ready to deal with. Yesterday I was talking about this idea of, well, just be yourself. And I said, well, what does that really mean? And I don't think that's very clear. And I think we can be quite deluded about who we really are. But what a more practical standard and value is, don't try to be somebody else. It's very common for young aspiring spiritual leaders to try to mold their actions, their conduct, even their style of Dhamma speaking and so on a teacher that they look up to. But it comes across as a little bit phony. So don't try to be somebody else, but to follow the principles of Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. And another principle, key principle here I'd like to stress is that of heedfulness or apamada, and particularly in the sense that the Buddha reserved the term aseka, aseka pugala, the one who has graduated, the one who has finished the training for the arahant. So as a teacher, you should always be reminding yourself that you are a student. You are a teacher stroke student. And you are teaching students stroke teachers, because if you forget that you're also a student, then you'll probably also forget that your students are also your teachers. And once you forget these things, then you can get into very rigid modes of relationship with people and expecting and demanding certain attitudes and certain kind of respect, when in fact these things have to be earned. And you have to be constantly training yourself and learning. It's not, you know, the tendency is, if your spiritual practice has reached a certain kind of steady level, to lose that real chanda and passion for further development. And that trap is much more likely to catch you if you're surrounded with people who think you're wonderful. So that's a real danger. And always keep coming back to yourself and your own practice, and that means finding time for formal meditation every day. Some people teach, promote formal meditation on a regular basis, but hardly do any themselves. And one of the reasons for that, I would suggest, is that meditation practice is non-quantifiable, or it's very difficult to say, today I put this many hours in and I got this much output. You know, there's input, there's process, where's the output? It's hard to say. But if you spend an hour in front of the computer or writing an article or counseling or teaching people, you have a real sense of achievement at the end of it. And I'm not denigrating these things. These are very much part of our life and our responsibility. But what I am pointing to is that it's a little bit dangerous, in the sense that we can enjoy that sense of achievement, tangible, measurable achievement, to the extent that we overlook and neglect the highly important, the vital inner work, which does not necessarily have a day-by-day obvious result that we can say, oh yeah, I got this today, or I achieved something. But in the long term, to be a good teacher and a creative teacher and one who can truly lead communities, this long-term steady work cannot be neglected. And my own teacher, Ajahn Chah, many of you will know, he didn't speak a word of English but was able to attract students from around the world. And often the teachings that he gave were wonderful and profound, but the majority of them were quite ordinary teachings that we would have heard or read elsewhere. But hearing a teaching directly from Ajahn Chah, the most basic teaching that you would find in an ABC of Buddhism, it struck you, it reached your heart in the most marvelous way, because of who he was, because of his integrity, because of his practice, because of his spiritual authority. So communication is not just a matter of having done the study, knowing your stuff, being articulate, but it's living it. It's who you are. And that's not something that you can fake. And without that, there's no really effective long-term transmission of the Dhamma. So this is a call for this heedfulness and real devotion to study and to inner practice, and to see that the more work that you put in, that even though you may not be able to identify it so clearly, you have that faith that it does affect your whole ability to model the teachings and to make them real and to give people a sense of hope. And if he can do it, so can I. She can do it, so can I. And this is absolutely vital. In one of the aspects of the monastic discipline which is often overlooked is that students have a duty to admonish with great respect their teachers if their teachers begin to act in eccentric or inappropriate ways. And in hierarchical societies, like in the ones that I live in particular, that's very difficult. Psychologically, it's very extremely difficult in a non-confrontational society like Thai society for the younger members of the community to give positive feedback to their, or to respectful admonishment to their elders. But and here you may say, well, I'm a teacher, you know, but I make a real effort to make myself open and to invite people to point things out. And that's very good. But you should also ask yourself, how often does it happen? Because often spiritual teachers or leaders in any kind of situation can make that kind of offer, but nobody really believes it. And that's evidenced by the fact nobody really takes people up on it. So there has to be a real sense of invitation, not just the words of invitation. So this devotion to Sila, the sense of humility that comes from looking and seeing clearly the work that needs to be done. Again, humility can easily become the Uriah Heep variety. Those of you who've read Charles Dickens, you know the most the person most lacking in humility, Uriah Heep, is always saying you should be humble. Just be humble. And of course, the whole irony of his character is he's not humble. So, you know, just paying lip service to humility is not enough. It's not something that you can adopt as a position. Humility comes from looking very clearly, fearlessly, neutrally at the nature of defilement arising and passing away in the mind without owning it and saying, I'm a bad person, I'm not really fit to be a teacher, I'm a fake because I still have these defilements. But realizing, yes, this is work that I've still got to do. And this is work that I'm devoted to doing. But in the meantime, I've got to do the best I can to help the people around me. So this constant looking within and letting go of self as a practice. Another value is understanding of the nature of the worldly dhammas, particularly praise and blame. And this is a constant test of your spiritual maturity. We don't say, you're a spiritual teacher, you should be equanimous, like a mountain is to the wind. You know, people praise and blame. You should not be affected by those things. This whole approach to spiritual life is you should be a certain way and you shouldn't be a certain way is completely hopeless. So don't get caught up in that. What we're looking at is what is praise, what is blame, what is the relationship that we have with them. And we start to notice, for instance, that the more we enjoy praise, the more that we are upset by blame. So if you just would like to live in a completely blame-free environment and only ever get praise, then you're living in a false paradise because those two things go together. And the only way that you'll ever be feel of anguish and disappointment, people blame you, is seeing the nature of praise as being just that way. It's just that. It's just that, nothing more. You're not better because someone praises you, and you don't become worse because somebody blames you. It's a nice story I'll tell you of a king who is advised by his wise minister, there's somebody coming to see you today, and he's a real flatterer. He's going to try and get his way with you. He's going to tell you you're wonderful. He's going to flatter you something terrible. Don't believe him, okay? So the king says, no, I won't. I won't believe any flattery. And the man comes in and immediately starts, oh, king, you're so wonderful, you're so wise, you're so young. He goes on and like this. And the king's just, thank you, thank you. And the prime minister looks at the king and he whispers in his ear, I told you, don't believe him when he flatters you. He says, it's all right, I haven't forgotten you. He hasn't started flattering me. All he said so far has been true. So being very careful with believing your own CV, believing your own propaganda, believing your own little sheet that the moderator reads out when he introduces you, and don't believe any of that. Don't believe your thinking. Always having the teachings of the Buddha as a reminder and as a standard, and your Kalyana Mitra. Even if you're a teacher, you always need someone that you can look to and that you can refer to. And your Kalyana Mitra should be a kalyana meter, is someone who meters, who gauges, who judges the amount of kalyana dhamma in your heart. It's not someone who just giving you praise all the time. And a something that I noticed in my teacher, Ajahn Chah, is he's so firmly founded in the Dhamma. He doesn't mind if you get angry with him. He doesn't mind if you hate him even, because he knows that what he's doing is for your own good, like a doctor who gives you medicine that you hate or a treatment that you don't want to have, because he knows it's the best for you. And so as a teacher, don't think you have to be popular all the time. You know, don't gauge your success as a teacher with the, you know, the smiling faces and the, oh, you're so wonderful. And as students, I'm not going to go over my time. I'm trying not to, but beware of charisma. There is a very strong correlation between the number of spiritual teachers who have betrayed their students and been involved in all kinds of impropriety and their charisma. That's not to say that all charismatic leaders are corrupt, but most corrupt spiritual leaders are charismatic. You know, what is the triple whammy is charisma, a good vocabulary, and a uniform. You know, if you've got those three things going for you, you know, you're going to have followers. And so be very wary of these things. Don't give them too much importance. I'm not saying that they're a sign that someone is not to be trusted, but keep this sense of it's not sure. And the morality and the conduct, rather than the propaganda, is really the case that where we can test and see whether this is a center, whether this is a teacher and a leader that I can give up to. So, yes, as teachers, we need to have this sense of devotion to study and to practice. And something that was mentioned this morning, I think that the Dhamma, I was thinking, someone used this thing of spreading the Dhamma. And I just thought, yes, the Dhamma's like butter, yes, isn't it? Because, why? Because if the butter is really cold, even though it's butter, you can't spread it. So how do you spread butter? You have to warm it up, and then you can spread it. And the Dhamma, the teachings, you know, it can be kind of hard and cold. So it needs that warmth, the human warmth of compassion in alliance with the wisdom of the Dhamma, and being willing to give up your own comfort, your own comfort zone for the welfare of others. This is not a Mahayana or a Theravada. It's not a teaching that is confined to any particular group, but this is the core value of Buddhism: wisdom and compassion. These are the wings of the eagle, as one teacher has said. So, as a teacher, you need to be very patient. Don't expect that what's obvious to you is obvious to your students. If it was completely obvious to them, then they'd be teachers and you'd be their student. You know, the fact that it's not obvious is the whole point. So being very patient and constantly trying to find new ways of getting through to people, of never sitting back on your laurels, but at the same time not giving so much to others that you neglect your own welfare. Don't get into this. Don't get isolated from people by having to try to create a certain kind of image of a teacher. And you may think you have to be aloof and to conceal your suffering and your imperfections. That's a dangerous path. Always have good friends that you can talk to. Don't get lonely, which is a major cause for monks disrobing when they get lonely as teachers. And don't get into kind of this self-pity. Nobody appreciates me. Nobody. So I'll end with this with a an anecdote, true story apparently, of this teacher who was just complaining, a leader actually, I said it was a leader, and sort of, I've done all these things, and I've done this, and I've done that, and I've got no recognition for it, no advance in my career, and now I'm being ill-treated, and this is going on, and nobody has come forward to stand up for me and help me. It's just so unfair. There's just this whole conspiracy of silence. He said, what should I do? And his friend said, join it. I'm about to join this conspiracy or association of silence, but before I do, there is an old poetic tradition in England and in Thailand of taking key words and then using the first letter of each word to begin a teaching or a line of poetry. So my blessing for you all is that you develop as leaders with wise attention, clear awareness, and non-attachment. Thank you.